Cliffcentral.com.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Mate Sessions with Cliff Central. My name is Mbali Njamane, and with me, as always, is my partner in crime. To Lisa Cindy, how are you, babe?
That's such an introduction. Thank you. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so let's not waste any time. Today, we wanted to do a show that addresses our sociology as South Africans and how it manifests in both our evolution as a society and our everyday relations as fellow humans. I, just to put this in context, was admittedly a bit slow to catch on to the Tipgate saga, but I have, and I kind of wish I hadn't, because I've definitely lost some sleep. This whole thing has messed with us in many ways, and in different ways, because Talisa and I don't always agree. Anyway, as much as we don't want to go into it, because that thing was a full-on knife fight, and that's not how we roll. But we did want to do a show in general, or rather in the general spirit of such things. Okay, so first and foremost, just to be clear, I am an individualist at heart, but I respect context. I don't believe in mob mentality, but I do believe in coexistence. I think in an ideal world, as individuals, we should be able to do whatever we want as long as it doesn't do harm to other human beings, which is where context and coexistence comes in. Because you do you, and I do me, but with our environment and with others in mind. Unfortunately, for most individuals, we're not able to draw the lines between our own freedom and the freedom of others, right? And it's often said that one man's freedom starts where another's ends, right? Because we're greedy, and we always want more than our fair share. It's not ideal, it's not constructive, but it's true. Particularly in a country where people's freedoms were systematically tiered in order of importance, in what was largely a zero-sum game. Some people benefited immensely and unjustly at the expense of others. And so, we have a lot of residual inequality that we cannot ignore. We know this, though. I know we're tired of it, but let's not theorize and try to cheat our way out of it. This is our context. Be it social, political, economic, or ideological, this country is not built on individual liberty. It's built on exploitation and systematic monopoly. It is dangerous, it is regressive, it is cowardice, and it is bullying. And it's not just white capitalist monopoly that I'm referring to. It is a culture of monopoly that I think is rampant in South Africa. It is true for the ANC and for much of the trade union movement as well. But as much as I don't think you can cure extreme monopoly with extreme monopoly, I don't think you can cure it with extreme individualism either. So we've got to find some middle ground between this individualist and collectivist mentality. Look, mobs are dangerous. However, the privilege of individualism, and I say the privilege because so many South Africans have been robbed of their agency. So the privilege of individualism...
Can't you say that? Just saying. It's a privilege, yes.
It is. It's very much a privilege. And that privilege in this country is qualified because it was and is so often attained by mobs at the gross expense of others. And FYI, a mob can be anything from a gang of apartheid criminals to a ruling party with a two-thirds majority. It's all the same bullying, in my opinion. And that's something people will disagree with, and I can see, Lisa, you want to disagree with that, but it is. It's you know,
it really isn't the same. I think, again, like you spoke about context, the weight of something, you know, with the history behind it and those sort of things, actually determines whether something is similar, even close to the same. So even though something is bullying, it really does still depend on the weight of the context behind that bullying, irrespective.
No, I understand, but I think that the bullying done by the apartheid government, right, for instance, and the bullying done by corrupt African governments, for me, has similarities, and in my opinion, it's almost worse if it's African governments. You know what I mean? I think corruption is corruption.
Okay.
Regardless, no, please.
I don't know. I think power manifests in very, very different forms. Corruption manifests in very, very different forms. And sometimes the extent to which something is exploited is at varying degrees.
But you can't get a free pass because you were a liberation struggle or movement if you're doing much of the same thing.
I don't think it's about a free pass. I don't think people deserve a free pass, but I certainly think they don't deserve the same weight of judgment. And I think that's the problem, that we're weighting things based on what a word means versus the gravity of what those actions actually.
Yeah, you see, I think that's where context is dangerous, because we often use context as a grounds for justification for similar behavior. So I'm saying, like, if you have one behavior, one manifests itself in a white colonial regime, and one manifests itself in an African liberation movement, but it's the same behavior with the same outcomes. For me,
but that's the thing. I don't even think it's the same outcomes to begin with. And also, one is reactive versus the other one being very, you know, deliberate. You know what I mean? So I just don't think the outcomes can
Yeah,
be
but
the
how,
same.
I mean, honestly, how far can this reactivity go?
Again, I'm not justifying
it. An eye for an eye is an eye.
I'm not justifying it. I am weighting them differently. And that weight is crucial, because it determines how we approach these things, because the outcomes are simply not the same. They're really not. They do not manifest in the same thing.
Okay, but I'm talking,
because the fundamental intentions are not the same.
Right.
So we cannot treat them as the same thing, as equal weighted things. They just
think you're talking more about intent than you are about outcomes. I'm saying there are situations, as it stands in South Africa, where and outcomes where I cannot differentiate between the actions of an apartheid regime and the actions of a liberation movement or an African government.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Anyway, we can have this debate a little bit later. But anyway, I think in regards to these things, it's something to be very mindful of. It's something we need to be aware of before we punt and we differentiate our sexy left wing versus right wing views. I think on either end of the spectrum, you can have corruption, and you can have bullying, and you can have monopoly.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, and so with that, we wanted, based on our show, from the lens of domestic work in South Africa, to explore the lines between one man's liberty and another's, or one group's liberty and another's. So we've invited a sociologist for a much-needed therapy session for South Africans. Tools, won't you introduce our guest?
I am very, very honored to introduce this young, beautiful lady. We are actually childhood friends. Our families are friends. So we've known each other since the very good old days. Her name is Ragi, and I used to know her by another name. And similar to me, we've also sort of changed to our African
name. Oh, by the way, Talitha used to be Florence.
Oh, you gotta do that, though.
Damn right.
Okay, I'm gonna expose you.
Damn right.
Vanessa, I'm proud. I'm a slave name.
so, So Ragila is an aspiring scholar and activist. She's currently a PhD candidate in sociology, and her work has been largely centered on identity politics, inequality, and socioeconomic development. She's a firm believer in bridging the gap between science, art, and the public. And in this regard, she's been active in communicating the social and political relevance of creative writing and literature to a number of audiences across the country. She's also presented her research to a number of international conferences. As a sociologist, one of the first concepts you're introduced to, as she says, is the sociological imagination. And simply put, this means that the individual can't be separated from the broader social and historical context in which he or she finds themselves in. So therefore, focusing on a group or even an individual gives you a broader understanding of the society as a whole. And in this light, Raghi is currently working on projects that emphasize telling stories of ordinary people and what their experiences can tell us about life in South Africa. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. And unfortunately, none of the domestic workers that a part of our project were willing to be part of this show in particular because they were afraid it would threaten their relationship with their employers. And we respect their livelihood first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And so that is a decision that we fully support, right, Jules?
Absolutely.
We did, however, talk to them extensively to develop questions for this session. And those are the questions we'll be addressing with Vanessa today. So, first of all, what to you, Vanessa, does the very existence... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm still calling you Vanessa. She is side-eyeing me for days. She's like, I'm a man, a better girl.
You know?
I don't have time for that. Okay, I apologize, Raggy.
No, look.
I'm sorry. That was not empathic. I've just never had a slave name. And so actually, I'm speaking from a position of privilege. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see what I mean?
Empower. Yeah, owning your own name, girl.
It's this privilege of individualism that we speak of. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not like... Mm-hmm. Yeah, shame. I'm being counter-revolutionary. Okay. Raggy, what does the very existence of the role of domestic worker say about us as a humanity? And secondly, so I found this role is treated and valued differently in different parts of the world. In the UK, for instance, housekeeping is a luxury, and these women come at a real premium with tight contracts and regulatory frameworks. So, what does our approach to domestic work in South Africa, and this is the second part of the question, what does our approach to domestic work say about us as a society? So I feel like we should address these separately, right? So first of all, the existence of the role of domestic worker, what does that say about humanity?
I think it's so difficult to begin talking about domestic workers without talking about domestic work as a concept itself, you know. And if you take things back, looking at why we had such an important movement such as the feminist movement, domestic work is at the center of it all, you know. When you look at women's work and the valuation of the work that women do in the home, it is taken as nothing, whether you are a domestic worker or a housewife or just an employed mother who comes back to do a second shift at home. The work itself is not valued, you okay. know. So from the roots, domestic work has been a problem. And the feminist movement itself wanted to place value on domestic work. So the fact that you're able to look after the kids and, you know, make sure your man looks good by the time he leaves to go to the office.
Isn't that taken for granted?
You know? Yeah. It would not be possible if the work in the domestic sphere had not been done first.
Okay, so for me, what's interesting that you're saying is that because it's almost domestic work is a byproduct in my mind, from what you're saying, of the work of nurture, of mother, of being, you know, a female isn't taken seriously enough to be accommodated in the workplace. And so it has to create the separation of roles. And so what you almost have in a domestic worker is an extension or a split in the role of mother, of wife, of nurturer, because these women wouldn't be able to do both and have careers as well. Is that what I'm hearing?
You become like the surrogate. You're the surrogate wife. You're the surrogate mother. You're the one who makes sure that the home is able to stand in the absence of both parties, because we need that function. We need someone looking after our children. We need a hygienic home to come back to, you know. And that is done at the expense mostly of the domestic worker's own home. So, I mean, there's the issue of power as well. And one woman's emancipation, meaning the lack of emancipation.
So it's what I was saying, right? Where one person's freedom starts, another's ends.
So I think the problem here is not really like what do we make of the role of domestic work in itself, but it's a question of value.
The role of women.
You know? What value do we place on the work that women are said to need to do, inverted commas, in the home?
And yet, even though the women of the houses have been stripped of that, you know, lesser role, right, of cleaning and cooking and those sort of things, they're still not necessarily seen as any valuable, right? Even though those tasks are not necessarily associated to the women of the house anymore.
Yes, that's the fundamental problem, you know. And what the feminist movement tried to do is place value on that work in monetary terms. So if you had to leave your job as a man and stay home and do that kind of work, how much would you charge to do that?
So this is interesting to me because of the amount that we pay to our domestic workers, which is a pittance, right? But really what it is, it's a reflection
of the value we place on the work itself
and of the role of females as nurturers, as mothers, as wives.
You know, there was even an entire argument that employers should be able to pay their domestic workers half their pay, because without the domestic worker, it would be impossible for the woman to leave the house and do that work in the first place.
But now,
that's the value that work has.
What is it saying about women, right, and how much we value ourselves? Okay, because I always think that's like first and foremost. How much do we value ourselves? What is it saying about us when we go and we pursue careers and we pursue success and wealth, right? Because fundamentally, we're of the role that we're able to delegate to the domestic worker. So we're able to earn now like a huge premium. What does it say about us as women when we leave this role behind, delegate it to somebody else, and then value it so little that we pay them a pittance?
That's the part that I find very interesting, that we pay it very little, which is such a reflection on how little we value it ourselves.
How little we value it. Yeah. And, like, I think what Mbali is saying is also a little bit problematic, because it's not just an issue of what does it say about us as women. Because, you know, in saying that, you kind of suggest that it is the woman's role to do these things. And we are not biologically functioned to clean. Yes, we do have the biological privilege to be able to birth children, but does that locate
amount
you in
that,
you know? Does does it restrict you
to the
home? I
guess what I was saying is, you know, this is a role that women inherently understand. I don't think it's a role that men rather, can relate to as well. So I was saying, I guess, from an empathic point of view, as women who can identify with the work that these women do, what does that say about our levels of empathy and sisterhood? The second part was around South Africa specifically as a society, and why are these women valued least in a society like ours, where, you know, like I said, I mean, friends of mine who come from the US, from the UK, they find this a very odd condition because, you know, for here it's such a standard thing, it's such a staple part of our society. But in those societies, like I said, it's a luxury. You know, these women are paid a premium to do what they do.
I think here what you said earlier about context comes into play greatly, because you need to look at in the first place, if you look just at the demographics and the demographic need in the UK, let's take France, for example, where people are literally incentivized to have families, to have children, because the population is so low that you get assistance to be able to meet both your career aspirations and also be able to manage the house. So that it's an incentive, whereas here in South Africa, we are already struggling with the issue of overpopulation. And you need to look at the demographic of who does domestic work in South Africa.
Right.
Is it not the black woman, the most undervalued woman in the world, you know? Is it not the black woman? And on top of that, is it not, in a lot of cases, migrant women who fall even lower than the black woman strata, you know? It's women from Lesotho, women from Zimbabwe. And that puts you in a particular position of not having any power. So,
why do you think in developed countries, in countries like France, like you mentioned, there is this demographic situation where people are being incentivized to breed, whereas here, it's almost, there's almost a disincentive.
Yeah. Girl, overpopulation. We are trying to cut down how much, you know, our fertility rates to a certain extent, because we do have, our population is skewed somewhat in the sense that we largely young, you know?
Yes.
And
that youth bulge.
You know, the youth bulge. And in a few years, we do have a bit of a problem on our hands. So I'm not a specialist in population and, you know, so I can't say too much about that, but that's one of the things we can take into consideration.
Okay.
So domestic workers' hours, we spoke to them about their hours, and whether it was, you know, sort of feasible and realistic or not, and, you know, the extent to which employers are allowed to you know, take of their time. And for the most part, they said that their working hours are from 7 to 4 o'clock, right, which is sort of a normal 8-hour workday, you know, with the occasional tea break and lunch break. But they also speak of how those hours aren't really upheld, and sometimes they have to start at 5:30. So it's almost like when the family wakes up, they wake up with the family. And they often still work after 6 o'clock. So after the family's finished, then they still have to do the washing up, maybe helping kids with homework, those sort of things, putting a child to bed. So what does it say of our ever-busy society if we need someone to shadow such a large part of our everyday lives? And do you think that the ladies... the domestic workers, do you think that they could be used as a source of routine establishment for families? So she essentially allows their lives to run like clockwork, and anything that's out of place is like a glitch in their well-planned means of survival in a world that's just asking so much of them at all times.
So this is slightly similar, but I think we're trying to interrogate, because we spoke about the role of feminism and of women in creating this condition, and the role of patriarchy. But I think she's talking kind of broadly, like you were saying, about routine establishment.
And I think, you know, for me, it also ties into, you know, the objectification of people to turn them into machines or technology, you know?
So what role do they play in the machine?
You know, I think we'd have to approach this question by looking at the issue of space, you know. It all begins, because in most cases you'll have that in instances where domestic workers live in the space in which they work, you know. So now you're mixing the work, the space of work, with the personal space, and the domestic worker is seen as a member of the family, inverted commas.
Big inverted commas.
Big inverted commas, yes. I mean, that's where you get terms like being called auntie, you know, as though you're part of the household. So the work that you do that is extra, like waking up when the family wakes up way before your working hours, and doing overtime on a daily basis, is not compensated for, and it's just seen as your contribution to family life. It's something you do for your own kids, except the difference here is this is not your family, and this is a workspace that is turned into a personal home, you know? So you literally are there to make sure everyone is able to meet their requirements, get to where they need to be on time, except in most cases they are not compensated for it, you know, and that's a huge problem.
So how do you establish boundaries, you know, in conditions so closely linked to each other that sometimes you can't tell the difference between the two?
It all begins with the one thing a lot of us get the moment you walk into your workplace, which is a contract that clearly states what your job requirements are, right? And also what your working hours are. And once that's written down and signed, you actually have a solid case, you know?
Shucks, so we're going to talk about this so much more later on. But what it's actually highlighting to me at the moment is that inherently, this is not a professional role. So it's very hard to govern professionally.
I mean, how many domestic workers do you know that actually have a contract?
Yes.
Exactly. And what you said about auntie, do you know what I mean? And what you said about, you know, being like a pseudo member of the family, even though you're not treated as such,
exactly,
is as us actually acknowledging that, you know, this is not a professional role.
Mm.
And actually, a question that I want to now bring in here is that of like guilt on our part, right? I've always speculated that part of the distance and the breakdown in the employer domestic worker relationship, as well as all the secrecy that surrounds it, is caused by shame on our part as employers. So I wonder how true do you think that is? Do you think that although we're driven as employers by self-interest, that deep down we know that what we expect of these women is not a job. It's very personal, and it crosses a certain line. Could that at least be part of why we don't want to acknowledge? It's like what you were saying about the mechanization of what they do, tools. Mm-hmm. Is this at least part of why we don't acknowledge their presence or their legitimacy as fellow humans?
Well, I think it's such a complex question. Like, I'd need to get clearer detail on what exactly you're referring to when you talk about secrecy.
So I'm talking about, you know, we've really struggled to get employers to speak on this topic, right? Because there seems to be a level of shame when you approach them.
Well, we're assuming, maybe.
No, that's what I assume. That's what I see, right? Is that they're, at the same time, it's a combination, like I'm saying, of self-interest and shame. Mm. Self-interest because they don't want to threaten the role, you know, the job that these women do.
Mm.
But a level of shame because they don't necessarily want, and for me this is actually the bigger part of it, they don't want you to know, to speak to a domestic worker and to know necessarily what is going on.
Mm.
And I mean, I'll speak for myself and I'll literally lay myself bare here. As much as I feel like I've been very good to my domestic worker, we were raised that way, you know, to really treat them like a part of the family. But we definitely haven't done that in absolute terms. And so because, you know, for instance, our domestic worker has never worn a uniform, our domestic worker stayed inside the house, you know, they never ate anything different than we did, right? But at the same time, they still had to clean our mess. They had to wash underwear at times. You know, they had to do and very, very intimate things that, like, now I look at in retrospect and think, you know, shucks, that was incredibly shameful. But whenever that happened, whenever I created a mess, let me put it this way, whenever I created a mess that my domestic worker had to clean, that I wasn't proud of, that would create a distance between her and I. So I would try and avoid her the whole day.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And I wouldn't be able to look her in the eye if I knew I was expecting her to do something that crossed a certain line.
Mm.
And so I'm saying, could that be a part of why we prefer to treat them as though they don't exist, to ignore them, is because there's a a level of shame that we feel.
I think, yeah, it goes back to what I was saying about the linking of the working space and the personal space. People tend to keep the family and the personal life rather private, you know. You only air out what's pretty about home, you know. No one will necessarily deliberately go and talk smack about what's happening in the house, you know. So in those cases, I think we also try to only highlight the fact that, yeah, I didn't make my domestic worker wear a uniform, but those intimate details that you speak of now, we keep that hidden. But I also think, to a large extent, we need to make a distinction between making your domestic worker feel part of the family and making her feel like she is an employee in the house, because that is essentially what she is. And when you make her part of the family, you extend certain
roles. And you create a false expectation.
Exactly. Okay. You create certain roles, like she will, your mother would wash your underwear. Your mother would wash your underwear and probably complain about it, but you do it because she's your mother. But as a worker, that is not your role. And if you do not put her in this, you're part of the family, it's less awkward for her to say, look, but this is not my job.
And I actually just want to add this question because I think it just fits in really, really well with that. But it's because I take great fascination in the objectification of human beings, because I see that happen on a very regular basis, and I also see it as an architect in space happen all the time. And I just want us to address that a little bit, you know, the mechanization of these women and how essentially you can face someone because you don't see them, right? Because you've made them in an image of something that is not comparable to you, that is not relatable to you, right? And so, because the ladies spoke to us about how they're never really allowed to stand still, and they always have to look busy. So sometimes they'll act busy if they have to, you know? And so I just want to touch on that a little bit, whether, you know, the ladies being in constant motion represents that mechanization of the woman, and the moment they stand still, they are a person that they have to see, they have to look them in the eye, and they have to address them, right? They're human. Where does that come from? You know, our ability to so easily find ways to objectify individuals.
You know, I think it, I want to link it to Karl Marx and what he spoke about, you know, when he was talking about industrialization of work and the concept of alienation, you know, making people so divorced from the, you literally need to just do your job. You know, you cease to be a person with aspirations or with a desire to fit into a social space. You're just there to do your job, you know. So I think it's a problem with a lot of workspaces. You need to constantly look like you are doing what you are being paid for, because time is money, you know. So if your employer, and it's not just in the home, it's not just domestic work, but generally, if your employer walks past, you grab something, you look like...
No, true, and we've all done it, right? Yeah, I mean, we all know from experience that nobody can work 8 hours nonstop. let's just be serious.
Yeah, it said that we're only productive for 3 of those 8 hours.
You know what I mean? But everyone also
truly
like
productive. The gospel.
Yeah, truly that's productive. The gospel. But also everyone has their own kind of work ethic, right? Some people work in bulk. I know I'm productive. I can be productive like for probably 5 straight hours and then I'm done, right? But that has to be timed very well, and then I can take maybe 5-10 minute break in between. Most people need much longer breaks between productivity. Okay, but no one is productive 8 hours a day. And as much as we know that, it's like you're saying, it is this culture of mechanization, and this, you know, is a whole other conversation about like how machines are essentially replacing humans.
And yet we're becoming those machines.
And exactly. Yeah. So, you know what I mean? It's this like very perverted thing that's going on. But, yeah, I think increasingly, like you're saying, people are having the expectations of human beings that they have of machines.
Of machines.
Which is like crazy to me.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because we were supposed to make machines more human. That was the idea behind the personal computer, and everything that we do was like, you know, how can we make a machine serve a human being? But now it's like clearly, you know, being perverted somehow, mm-hmm. at least I think. Mm-hmm. But yes, we're on Facebook. You know what I mean? Like, I promise you, social media and personal communication probably takes up 3 hours of the average employee's day. And we all know that. And probably the boss does it as well. But we've gotten very good at this, like, looking busy, like you're saying.
Mm. Yeah, click every three seconds.
Exactly. And I mean, that's why you have companies like... I don't think I'm allowed to say company names on radio. But you have progressive companies that'll have something like a nap room.
Google.
Yes.
There we go. I said it.
Okay. Are you allowed to say that?
No, I didn't even know she was saying. I'm speculating. I'm speculating. I don't know who she's talking about.
Well, Google's a verb now. You Google.
Okay, exactly. Yeah, actually, so we're like, yeah.
Okay.
That have nap spaces, that have food. I love food. That's food, you know. It's acknowledging the human aspect of your employees.
Are they,
you know?
Are those spaces as productive as?
I think sometimes they're even more productive because you acknowledge a person as a social being first, you know, as a person with. You are not as productive if you're restless or if you feel like someone is watching over your your shoulder.
Literally, I've written an entire piece on this, and actually, like, just to give a personal anecdote, probably the day that I decided to quit, I won't say which job, I've had not that many, so it probably won't be hard for people to guess. Anyway, anyone who knows me, my director called me into the office one day because he didn't like my posture in my chair.
Oh,
yeah. He was like, you know what the thing is? It wasn't about my output. It wasn't about my performance. But he was like, you always just look really comfortable.
Wow. You look
That's
happy.
You just, you know what I mean? You look really comfortable, and I don't think it's giving the right impression. And, like, sometimes you go for walks, and, I mean, you've been seen going for walks and sometimes sitting in the courtyard working. And, look, I know it's not about your performance. Actually, you know, and I'm actually sorry to have to say this, but it's just, it's raising some issues around your perceived productivity.
Very interesting. But you know what? I actually want to find out, because sometimes when you offer, as a boss, when you offer your employees trust, they can take advantage of it, right? And I've done that before with some of my bosses. And I wonder then, how do you find the balance? So you grant them their humanity, right? You understand that as humans, they have certain human requirements. But in the same breath, how do you mitigate, you know, the possibility of someone taking advantage of that trust?
Isn't that the reason why we have sanctions and, you know, disciplinary codes and all of that? Because, I mean, the reason we put those things in place is for the mere fact that it's human nature to try to overstep boundaries and, you know, to step out of line sometimes. So in the event that that happens, you deal with the situation. But I don't think you should generally approach someone from the position of, I don't trust you, therefore you have to
agreed.
Do this and this.
And on that point of trust, I think brings us to our next question, right? We hear a lot from these women about the trust issues their employers have. For instance, that they're always suspected first of theft. And I'm talking about now domestic workers, right? They're always suspected first of theft when something is misplaced. And then they're made to look for it. And when they find it, there's not necessarily an apology. Mm-hmm. There's kind of an awkward silence.
So you found it.
or that they're not allowed to receive visitors on the property, or that they're actually afraid to be seen with other domestic workers because they're then interrogated as though they were planning something. Or that, and this one really, like, guts me. I mean, they all gut me, but this one really guts me. Even when they're sick, they're suspected to be carrying a deadly disease that they could spread to the family. Okay? And so I feel like South Africa in general is plagued by trust issues. And so that's why I want to use this as an example, as a case study, to kind of interrogate our broader society. What does this sort of suspicion that we have toward one another or among one another do to a human and to human relationships? And at the same time, and for me, this is like mind-blowing. This is what messes with me. At the same time, if these women are trusted with the care of employers' children, the maintenance of the household, the preparation of meals, such sensitive things, how can this extreme suspicion and extreme trust coexist?
You know, I need to refer you to a movie which changed my view on life.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called?
That was such an anticlimax. No,
like, we were literally sitting with bated breath.
Yeah.
Will it come to you?
Something about these. The life of these.
The life of, I don't know.
No. Is it with Dakota Fanning? The little girl. Is it with Queen Latifah? Yes.
The Secret
Life of Bees.
The Secret Life of Bees. Ladies and gentlemen, we have it. Fear not.
I agree with you, yes.
So, yes, I need to refer you to the movie The Secret Life of Bees.
Mm.
There is a line in that movie that has stuck with me. I watched that in high school. And I think at that point, I understood the fundamental problem with racism, right? Oh, wow. This woman asks, how can you hate me so much? But trust me with your children, you know. You literally raise families for these people. You make their meals. You're so involved in their intimate spaces, but you never belong. And I feel like it's, you know, when you talk about domestic work and when you talk about South Africa in general, you cannot divorce it from race, from class, from gender.
Although some people would like to think so.
You can't have a conversation about South Africa without talking about those things. And unfortunately, domestic workers are black, bottom of the ladder. It's considered one of the lowest social classes you could be in, bottom of the ladder. And they're women. You know, it's a triple burden. And it's so unfortunate that because of where society is, in South Africa, the fact that black people are at the epitom of poverty and a lot of the times have to resort to crime because of the living conditions that exist in the country. Obviously, when something goes missing, it has to be the black woman in the house because she has a poor family back home to send your t-shirt to, doesn't she?
But do you know how funny that is to me, right? Because you've got South Africans who will not acknowledge that crime, and not in absolute terms, but in large part, is due to an economic condition. At the same time, the reason that they suspect you is because you come from nothing.
And they
so
keep you at nothing. The wages keep you at nothing, you know? And I also, I'm a firm believer in not painting people as merely victims, right?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So a lot of the time, yes, domestic workers do steal things. Yes, they do take some things.
Is it a lot
home.
Of the time? Is it?
And I, you know, before this, I went and spoke to a lot of people, and it happens.
It does happen.
I'm not disputing that it happens.
I don't
happens.
Think it's a lot.
I'm wondering
I don't
about
know if I'd
gravity.
Go as far as far a lot of the time.
Let's say sometimes.
Okay.
It does happen that they do steal something or take something home. But in those instances, it's usually a form of agency, a form of fighting back against what you're
That's
constantly faced with.
Wow.
That's interesting.
Every single day, you go to this house and you see what we call black aspiration.
So this is what you're, so this is the question around, like, what does it do to the relationship?
What does it do to the relationship? Okay. Every day you're faced with, they have this and this and this that they probably don't even value. You know, it's probably a t-shirt that is hardly worn, that is just thrown there. And you know that I know someone who would appreciate this. So maybe they wouldn't notice if it went missing. So a lot of the times it's not because, you know, they're
out of spite. Or
out of spite, but it's out of need, out of necessity that, you know what?
You know, I mean, what I wonder, and what is also a great interest of mine with regards to crime, are things that are turned into crime, even though it isn't, right? Mm. So, it's almost, and I see this a lot with American conditions, with things like the war on drugs, right? Mm. And how certain actions are criminalized that are not criminal, right? And it's a way to perpetuate the idea of the black man as criminal,
yes,
as bad, as whatever, 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 right?
Yes.
And then I wonder about that in our society as well, whether certain things are criminal just because a lot of the things that poverty needs to do becomes criminalized so that they do not self-sustain or do not become resilient, versus things that are actually truly crime, you know?
I have a problem with this, and it's similar to the problem that I raised earlier in my introduction around, you know, I guess what we did was we spoke about classes of bullying, you know? Sometimes it's reactive, and sometimes it's deliberate. So sometimes it's justified, and sometimes it's not. And I think this is a very dangerous space. It's a very it's a difficult line to draw, because what you're saying, it's a very sensitive line.
But it needs to be because, said, I think.
Yeah, no, sure. Because what you can do one of two things, right? Because we all understand that, you know, certain crimes can be reactive and they can be out of need. We can give every criminal a free pass, right?
No. Yes.
Doesn't say it's one. No, I'm saying it's one of it's one of two things, right?
But I'm not saying that reactive crime is not crime. I'm just saying that some crimes are not crimes, right?
Yeah, but we can't.
Can
we can't.
Example?
But for me, to be honest, you know, it boils down. You know, people talk about intent and outcomes, and I kind of am in two schools of thought. I really think intent is important, but I think in this case, I'm going to advocate for outcome. If somebody is killed,
yeah,
in a crime. Right? A violent crime. Whether that was justified or not, whether that was an assassination, right, by a corrupt government, you know, I don't know, some CIA agent or whatever happens, or whether that was out of, that comes out of a robbery, a violent robbery, right, that perhaps comes out of people who are desperate. You know, the mere fact that they're at the end of that, the end to that is that a life is taken.
Yeah.
Right? For me, I can understand, I think in that from that perspective, those things to me are weighted equally.
See, I'm not talking about those sort of extremes, right? I think there's certain things that are very clearly crime, right? But then I'm referring to things like a young black man standing in the street, and that it's literally as simple as that in America, right? Unless they're telling us a completely different story, because we know how media can manipulate us and those sort of things. But sometimes a black man walking in a hoodie becomes criminal, right? Mm. Or a black man smoking weed makes them get life in jail, right? Those sort of things.
So you're talking about suspicion.
Yes.
You're talking about suspicion then being criminalized.
Yes, but it's a criminalization of...
I think it's the criminalization of black bodies.
Of identity.
In general.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay, yeah. So it's not the criminalization of outcomes. It's the criminalization of identity.
Yes.
There I can agree with you.
Because then everything can be criminal.
There I can agree with you.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're like almost you're guilty without being proven innocent.
Absolutely.
Right, fair. I mean, rather you're guilty before.
Yeah.
What was the first?
You get what we mean.
You're guilty. Hold on. No, come on. We have to get this right. This is horrible.
Guilty.
You're guilty unless proven innocent. That's the one.
But I mean, as a poor person, how likely are you to be proven innocent? You know, because innocence is in a way also a privilege. You know, because you have to be able to access that ability to be proven innocent. So you're more than likely to remain guilty if you ever even walk into a courthouse, you know?
But the way our prisons are for. It takes so long for you to get to court.
Mm. And so all you remain is a criminalized body.
Hmm. Yo. yeah, no, this idea of a criminalized body, Shem. Yeah, that's a separate problem, I think.
Yeah. It's a topic all on its own.
It is, but I think it does transcend into what a black woman is perceived in the house, in the home. I definitely think that she fills that role in some way as well.
I think it ties in also to who is allowed to visit, because sometimes it's not necessarily her that is suspicious, but all the other bodies associated with her.
Yeah,
you know.
Mm. Yes.
Because in truth, not a lot of female bodies are considered criminal unless you're considered or suspected to be a prostitute or something.
Hmm.
Women are not too often. It's a lot of times black men that are perceived to be criminals. And unfortunately, we are associated with black men who happen to be our husbands, who happen to be brothers. Our sons, our brothers, you know. And that's where the issue of visitation comes in. Who is allowed to visit you? For how long?
So can I flip this thing around? Because I always think there's a flip side to a coin. And I'm hopping on because, like, I really believe this. Look, so what we were saying earlier, okay, so now we're talking about suspicion. The criminalization of suspicion, right? Mm. And I want to say to you, I want to bring it back to what we were saying earlier on about a mob mentality, and a mob being anything from, you know, a group of apartheid criminals to a party, a leading party, a ruling party with a two-thirds majority, right? That's what I was saying earlier on. And then you argued with me because you were like, well, you know, it's not the same bullying. And I was like, yes, but it is. And I think that, and I'm not talking now about like hard crime, but I'm talking at least about oppression as a crime against humanity. Let's talk about oppression.
Yeah.
Right? For me, a white man, regardless of his background, regardless of his stance, will always be suspected first of being oppressive. I think it's harder for us to wrap our minds and to come to terms with the idea of a black government or a black man filling the role of oppressor.
I think that the perception is not that they are oppressors or oppressive, but that they are part of a system that places them in a position that oppresses, whether they know it or not. That's what I think.
I think I'd counter that altogether. I think from the get-go, black men, and that's why I find black masculinity so interesting, black men have been painted to be oppressive people in general. Oppressive. I think Janssen, just looking at the Janssen case, it's such a
okay, but not
prime example.
I'm talking about systematic oppression, hey?
Mm.
I'm talking at that level of like, and
at the level of government.
This is where I made the comparison between a corrupt black government and a corrupt white regime.
I think.
With similar outcomes.
At the core, when you think of African governments, right?
Mm.
Does not the word corruption always, is it not always linked to African governments?
Yes.
You know?
Mm.
The downfall of Africa and the African economy is always linked to corrupt government because it's being ruled by black politicians. I think from the onset, from blackness and black power has been problematized.
Shucks.
It's not a new thing.
I'm just quickly wondering then, what is your perception of the white body versus the black body, right? In terms of what Bali's referring to in relation to oppression. So what do you think the white man represents versus the black man?
I think to this day, to a large extent, in a lot of our minds, the white man represents order. Think oh, about
corrupt
it.
Order.
Oh, corrupt order.
Do you see what I mean? Yes. So for me, it's levels. Okay. So at a goon level, mm-hmm. right? Black governments are always accused of that kind of goonery, that kind of criminalized corruption. But if we think about now corruption at a systemic level, which is for me what colonialism was.
It was.
You know what I mean? And a lot of what happens in the United States, it seems very much above board. It's mm-hmm. it's orderly, like you're saying, but it's corruption at a very, very high level.
But it's also considered to be more acceptable. Because I was in my home country, the DRC, just 2 years ago. And so often I heard people talk about how the country would still be in good standing if the white man was still there, knowing full well that the looting of resources.
Absolutely.
And I mean, so much went wrong because
Trevor Noah jokes about it all the time, but you know, go ahead, yeah.
But the fact that we think, you know what, even with all his corruption, even with all his slavery, all his oppression, if the white man was here, things would be better, tells you what kind of oppression we prefer.
But why then don't we think, why don't we ever suspect black governments of being capable of corruption on that very systemic indoctrinated level?
I don't think we plan like that. I don't know. That's me. I just don't think we plan
So I am seeing things culturally in this country, politically, from a cultural perspective, taking hold. Where I look and I think about 10 years from now, 50 years from now, if this situation continues, I can see how this corruption becomes systematized.
I don't see it becoming systematized. I see it as individuals, right, gaining a lot of authority, a lot of power, a lot of wealth. But I don't see it as a very deliberate attempt to make it this new way.
But you don't think it can be you don't think it can be systematized at some point, if we don't guard against it.
We will go back to the sociologist, the specialist, but I personally don't see it as that because it was very, very strategic, you know, the white version of this.
I think we give, and this is a conversation I have with a lot of people, let's not have the illusion that just because it's a black man, oppression is not deliberate,
Thank you.
Black people are intellectual beings.
They're highly,
well,
and it's insulting for me. Sorry, just to interrupt you, and this is getting heated.
But it is insulting
to me if you think that a black man's corruption, a black man's oppression is somehow inferior to a white man's oppression.
No, not inferior, different.
Different, reactive, but that it cannot become as sophisticated convoluted.
It's not about the level of sophistication. I think it can manifest into something different because the way that we constructed to begin with.
But that excuse, that free pass that they're getting
it's
here
not
is
a
what,
free pass.
Okay, that's fine. But that idea, that preconceived idea that it's strategic, it's reactive, whatever you're saying, is what's actually going to empower it to be all the more pervasive and invasive.
Absolutely don't agree.
I agree.
Thank you.
I think a lot of the times we have this idea that the black man is the utopia of the perfect humanity, and it's not the case.
And it's,
you know,
he's the victim, the perpetual victim. Yeah.
No. I'm not rationalizing it based on the idea of their victimhood.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
I think when a system works.
A gross assumption.
I apologize.
When a system works and it works in your benefit, a lot of the times you will choose your own upkeep over the upkeep of another. If it benefits you, you'll take that role.
Isn't that human nature that you're talking about, though?
Exactly.
It's universal, right? There's a tipping point for anyone. There is a tipping point for anyone.
I think if we were given the opportunity to actually search deep, and it's so unfortunate that history is written by those in power, but if we were to search deep to black history, right, to African history, and find out exactly what kingdoms we took over and how we did it, I'm sure we'd find some interesting ideas there on how to take over a system, how to employ a system for your benefit, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, the kings and chiefs that sold our African brothers into slavery, they did not take the Africans, smuggle them into a ship. It was a transaction.
And this is the thing for me. True. Black supremacy is coming, which is why it's like so much more scary for me. It's coming from a place of martyr and of victimization. And for me, something that comes from that point with any kind of sinister agenda is going to be that much more pervasive because we won't see it coming.
But do you think the movement is more sinister than it is productive?
I'm scared. I'm always like, look, this is my thing. It's like, I can't, I never really speak for now because it's a hot mess, but I will say, no, but I will say, I always speak for now in terms of the fact that, like, look, we're not doing enough reflection. We're not doing enough.
Do we have time for reflection? Because I hear myself say this, I realize the flaws in that question. But do we have time for it? Because I find that a lot of the time.
If we don't make time for it, we're just going to repeat history. And a lot of what we're doing as Black people at the moment rides on the coattails of white oppression.
But I find that a lot of the times all that Blackness and people of color are doing is literally explaining their existence.
But we have a responsibility as the underdogs, as the victims, to be better.
We absolutely do, with a lot of weight, right? I don't know. I think the extent of the weight, right, that is on Blackness to at all times prove themselves, at all times justify the existence, that sort of thing. There's quite a weight to that takes a lot of times, that takes up a lot of time, and that distracts, right? So we're so busy. I mean, that's what I find about almost every movement, right? We're so busy explaining it at all times.
And refining it, by the way, in the process.
Yes, but it's time consuming.
It's time consuming. And I would rather end up with a movement that is self-reflective, self-aware, and that is not doomed to repeat mistakes of the past that takes its time. I'd rather end up with a movement like that actually rises above whatever has happened and doesn't seek to right a wrong simply by taking an eye for an eye, but by actually... raising the bar for humanity.
But
I prefer that kind of movement.
But
the kind of movement that is chasing some kind of urgency.
But I think to interpret the violence as an eye for an eye is also unfair, because I don't think that's what it is either.
You and I always disagree on this. I think it is. I think it is very much.
I really don't
think
it is.
No, but if I think about
it, I think sometimes
the trajectory of Black success, right, has its roots in, like I was saying earlier, trying to cure one extreme with another. So trying to replicate what was done to us.
If your mother disciplines you and you're frustrated as hell, right? You know you did something wrong, but you are livid as hell that your mother caught you or that your mother did something to you, and you take a chair and you throw it at something, right? That is a form of violence. But is that also a reflection on the hurt that you want to inflict on her? Is it a reflection of a hate that you feel for her?
No, but
I think that violence manifests in very different forms. It is not just one thing. It is not just the inverse
of something
bad.
I think that
bad.
There are those and of I, us that have the benefit of not being that reactive anymore. So we can't actually now, we can't blanket Blackness.
Just right. Like we can't blanket violence.
Exactly. We can't blanket it, right?
Yes,
and
cannot.
So there are still people in such dire straits where I can understand the argument that, you know, a lot of their actions are reactive. But then there are people who, you know, there are Black people who are privileged.
Yeah.
Who I think have the time to contemplate and to reflect. And I don't see among them enough self-awareness and rising above.
But do they have that time, or does Black tax come into play as well?
And
Yes, but that is exactly what it is. That is the problem. I mean, we talk about it as if that's not a thing, as if we should just get over it, or now we're in a position of privilege, therefore
I'm not denying the taxes. I'm denying the fact that we're using them constantly as an excuse.
No, that is not an excuse. It is simply factual that is a part of the factors that determine our progress as humans.
Yeah, but I'm saying that if we have, I'm saying it's so easy as a black person to get away with so many things because you get certain free passes, even if you're aware. And I think so many people are
giving these free passes. By simply making that statement, you're assuming that it is one pass and another pass and another. By making that statement, we're not saying
that. I think we're giving ourselves free passes.
Let them be. We're saying, listen, this is an actual thing that we have to realize.
I think we're far too forgiving of our own elites and our own leaders. I honestly think so. And I think it's dangerous. And that's, for me, that's like, enough.
I just think it's too much of a blanket
statement. But I also think that you're also a bit too condemning as well.
That's exactly what I'm saying. That's what
it's,
I think.
It's a bit of both, because as Mbali is saying, our leaders need to be made accountable. There are some things that are just ridiculous. You do not let things like that slide, and I don't need to mention anything, you know. You do not let things like that slide. But in the same breath, you need to think about, I mean, we're such a new democracy, for one, you know. There's still a lot that we are learning. A lot of systematic injustices that are inherited that we need to let go of. So, and also, like, we also need to debunk, where are we getting our information from? Yes. Like, who owns the media? What exactly, the intention behind the stories that are portrayed? What stories are hidden?
Sure.
What successes are hidden?
Enough. No, and that's fine. That's good and well, but, you know, in my opinion, if you take the ANC government as it stands, and our president himself, you can not tell me that is a man that is absolved of intent. That is, and with that, I'm done.
Intent is just not enough, is all I'm saying.
Okay. What if that happened? And I think that's a wrap. That brings us to an end of part one of this conversation. Just as a closing point, I'd like to quote a philosopher who said, "A great many people think they are thinking when they are simply rearranging their prejudice." I'm realizing that more and more, as something that I do. And something that we all do. And I think it's important to constantly ask ourselves the question. Because I certainly will. And with that, Lisa, any last words?
I'd actually like to pass it off to Raggy. Is there any final
I'm
words?
Not good at
like?
Last words. Power to
you
the people.
You can sing. Power to the people. Amanda. Okay then.
But it has been an absolute pleasure, Raggy, and I look very, very forward to the next conversation.
Yeah, Shucks,
thank
you're
you
like,
so much
no, seriously, you're such incredible value add, because Talitha and I just speculate and we fight. And actually, like I said in the beginning, exactly, and like I said at the beginning of this conversation, about, you know, Tipgate.
Tipgate.
Yes.
I like the name.
Like I said about Tipgate, look, we both were troubled by the thing, but probably for different reasons because we don't always agree.
Yeah.
But that's important. And thank you guys, as always, for joining us on the Made Sessions with Cliff Central. Please tune in next week for part two of our conversation. Look after yourselves and have a good one.
Cliff Central. The revolution. I've got something important to tell you. CliffCentral.com.